All right, next thing we're going to talk about is prostaglandins. Now, prostaglandins are produced during what process? Inflammation. All right, so they are actually one of the control mechanisms of inflammation. If we reduce prostaglandins, we will also reduce inflammation. Now, what do we say increases sensitivity of pain receptors? Inflammation, and in particular, what three substances associated with inflammation? Prostaglandins is one. Okay, what's another one? Histamine, and substance P. All right, so those three substances are highly associated with inflammation and pain. Now, what we're going to do in this little section is we're going to inhibit prostaglandins. Now, they sensitize nociceptors. They're made from arachidonic acid. Now, arachidonic acid is kind of like a multitasking substrate. It can turn into multiple things depending on the enzyme that controls it. So, arachidonic acid can turn into what three things? Prostaglandins, leukotrienes, and thromboxanes. Now, we'll talk more about the other two later. In terms of prostaglandins, the enzyme responsible is called COX, or cyclooxygenase. Now, as it turns out, you have two different types of COX in your body. COX 1 and COX 2. Thing 1 and thing 2. Just like Dr. Seuss. Now, COX-1 is not associated with inflammation. It's associated with what we call homeostatic functions. It's responsible for maintaining your stomach lining. It's responsible for macrophage differentiation. It's responsible for platelet aggregation. And it's responsible for renal function. Normal, everyday stuff. And then we have COX-2. COX-2 is only released during inflammation, and it's going to cause and mediate inflammation and thereby the P word, pain. All right, so in visual form, arachidonic acid can turn into prostaglandins via COX-1 or COX-2. COX-1 is going to be what we call homeostatic functions. COX-2 is going to be inflammation. Now, there's a couple things that can inhibit prostaglandins. Steroids can inhibit prostaglandins. So if a person is having inflammation and pain because of that, we could stop it by giving them steroids. What's the problem with the steroids? A lot of side effects, right? So rather than giving them steroids, you might want to give something maybe a little bit more focused. And that more focused is called NSAIDs. Now, there's one drug that inhibits COX that does not cause anti-inflammation, and we'll talk about that one at the end. You know it as Tylenol. All right, so NSAIDs. It is a generic term to mean any drug that inhibits inflammation but does not affect cortisol receptors. Works by inhibiting COX. Now, we can be selective or non-selective. Selective ones are going to inhibit which COX primarily? Which one do you think we want to inhibit? COX-2. Now, the theory was that by selectively inhibiting COX-2, you would get fewer side effects. But in practice, it hasn't worked out so well. You might know the drug Vioxx. Vioxx is a selective COX-2 inhibitor that had more side effects. You might have heard of Bextra. Again, same thing, taken off the market because of too many side effects. You may have heard of Celebrex. Now, Celebrex was successful in that it doesn't hurt people's stomach as much. If you give it to a person for less than a year, they're going to have fewer stomach ulcers than someone who gets a non-selective drug. If you give it to them for more than a year, guess what? No difference. So anyway, it was a good idea, but it hasn't worked out in practice so much. But again, Celebrex does have fewer GI side effects within the first year. All right, now our non-selective COX inhibitors, I've put a couple down here. Aspirin is the big one that it came around first, but it's different than all the others. We'll talk about it in a bit more detail. Ibuprofen and naproxen, you should know those because you can find them over the counter. Diclofenac is better known as Voltaren. Its claim to fame is that it is the strongest, but also has a lot of side effects. Indomethacin, it's better known as Indocin, and it is a very old drug. It works like crazy. I mean, it is a really good inhibitor, and it reduces pain, it reduces inflammation really well, but a lot of side effects. Very dirty drug. Now, why do I mention it here, though? Because physicians like to prescribe it for gout. Now, gout is an inflammatory disease that causes some severe pain when you get a flare. And for some reason, Indocin became kind of the drug of choice for a long time. Now, it doesn't work any better than any of the others for gout, but there's just some doctors who that's what they're going to give. So you need to know what Indocin is. If you see that, you'll know what it's being used for. You'll know what it is. Sulindac, they use at the VA. So if you go to the VA, you might see this being used. They also give ibuprofen out like candy. Then ketorolac, better known as Toradol. If you'd like some brand names. Indocin and Toradol. Now, Toradol is a very important drug because if you can give this drug IM or IV as well as giving it PO. When you give it IM or IV, you actually get more analgesic effect than when you give it PO, and you get similar to a low-dose opioid. So giving Toradol is equivalent to giving a low dose of codeine or oxycodone, but without all of the mental clouding, constipation, da-da-da-da-da. So sometimes when you'll see patients in the ER or come from the ER, they give them Toradol. Or if you have a patient who's post-op, they'll give them Toradol in addition to opioids. So you need to know that Toradol is given IV and IM as well as PO. And its claim to fame is that when you give it IV or IM, it is as strong as a moderate opioid. We can get rid of valdecoxib and rofecoxib because they're off the market. So now we just have Celebrex. All right, any questions about the drugs themselves? All right, let's talk about aspirin in particular. Aspirin is used for more things than any other COX inhibitor because it is special. Now, all of the other COX inhibitors, when they bind to COX-1, they bind reversibly, which means that the effect can wear off. Now, when aspirin binds to COX-1, it does so irreversibly. So its effects don't wear off until the cell that was affected dies. So it's a little bit different than the others. So we can use it for suppression of inflammation. The problem with using it for suppression of inflammation is that it takes high doses. Most people are going to get adverse GI effects and will not be able to take high enough doses to really reduce the inflammation enough. Here we're talking about inflammatory diseases like rheumatoid arthritis. So you can use it for this, but it doesn't really work that well because the adverse effects at high doses are so bad. We can use it to reduce pain. Works pretty well for things like headaches. It was originally used for what purpose? Aspirin comes from willow bark, and willow bark was used as long ago as Herodotus to reduce pain during childbirth. Next one is reduction of fever. It is an antipyretic. By inhibiting the inflammatory process, you reduce fever. Dysmenorrhea. What's that? Come on, ladies. I know you know this one. Menstrual cramps. So it can be used to reduce menstrual cramps. Suppression of platelet aggregation. So if a patient needs to be unclotted or prevent clotting, primarily platelet-type clotting, which is going to be on the arterial side, so we can use these drugs, we can use aspirin to reduce platelet aggregation and thereby prevent what two things from happening? Clotting in the heart would be causing a heart attack. Clotting in the brain, stroke. So we can use aspirin to prevent stroke and heart attack. We also use it to treat acute heart attacks. If a person comes into the ER and they've had a heart attack, what is the number one drug they need to be given? Aspirin. Now, the reason I ask you this is because, you know, people on the street know this answer. Aspirin. But when I ask this on a test every year, I get like a third of the class gets it wrong. So, number one drug to give when a person has been diagnosed with a heart attack is aspirin. All right, colorectal cancer prevention. There's some evidence that taking an aspirin a day can actually prevent colon cancer. And then there's some evidence that it can protect against Alzheimer's disease. All right, now, adverse effects. GI pain and ulcer. Now, what is the difference between pain and an ulcer? Okay, an ulcer is an actual eroding of the lining of the stomach. You actually get a hole in your stomach or intestines. And pain is when you feel pain. Now, can you have an ulcer that doesn't hurt? Yes, you absolutely can. Can you have pain with no ulcer? Yes. One of the very difficult things to get patients to understand is that concept. They'll think that if they hurt, they must have an ulcer. Not necessarily. You can have GI upset with NSAIDs and aspirin without having an ulcer. And you can also have an ulcer without having pain. Now, because of this, if a patient is on an NSAID long term, sometimes we want to put them on another drug. That's what that word adjuvant means, another drug that adds to the therapy and helps to prevent ulcers. Now, bleeding. Why would a person bleed who's taking aspirin or another NSAID? Yeah, because it inhibits platelet aggregation. Now, at the same time that it's inhibiting platelet aggregation, because it's also interrupting the lining of the stomach and giving them a possible ulcer, does that make them even more at risk for bleeding? Yes. And the number one cause of death with aspirin is GI bleeding. Okay, so menstrual cycles, the reason for that is because the what tells a woman's uterus to contract is prostaglandins. So, you know, if we want to induce labor in childbirth, what they'll do is they'll put artificial prostaglandins in her uterus, and that'll cause it to contract. So when we inhibit those prostaglandins, it makes the uterus relax. Which is why Tylenol does not work for menstrual cramps, because it doesn't cause that to happen. All right, so GI, the way they get ulcers, prostaglandins are in charge of telling your stomach to produce mucus. If you inhibit prostaglandins, guess what your stomach doesn't produce as much of? It doesn't produce as much mucus. That smaller mucus protection can lead to ulcers. Renal impairment. Because COX-1 is in charge of maintaining renal function, giving too much can cause that. Salicylism is an overdose of aspirin. You can look up the symptoms. They're fun. Reye's syndrome. Now, Reye's syndrome is a condition that some children get when they have a viral illness and then get aspirin on top of that. It can cause severe mental retardation, and that's why we don't give aspirin to children anymore. It's why there's no such thing as baby aspirin anymore. Now it's called low-dose aspirin because you don't want to give it to babies. Why? Because it could cause Reye's syndrome. Now, Reye's syndrome is not that common, but it was common enough that you just don't want to risk it. It's a pregnancy category D drug, which means we do not want to give it to a woman who is pregnant. And then finally, some people are allergic to it. All right, it interacts with other drugs that cause similar side effects. So, warfarin is an anticoagulant. If you give two anticoagulants together, guess what you get? More anticoagulation, higher risk of bleeding. And in the case of aspirin, higher risk of what type of bleeding? GI bleeding. Glucocorticoids, steroids. Steroids also inhibit inflammation. So if you give an NSAID or an aspirin along with the steroid, guess what you get? An even bigger reduction in inflammation. Alcohol. Alcohol damages the stomach lining. If you give aspirin and alcohol together, guess what you get? More risk of GI bleeding. Ibuprofen. Ibuprofen and aspirin work similarly. So you're going to get more effect, more side effect, more so than more pain relief in this case. Any questions about aspirin?
Mixed with caffeine, it intensifies the effect of the aspirin.
All right, now, caffeine causes vasoconstriction of the arteries in the brain. So when you give caffeine along with aspirin or ibuprofen, what you do is it helps the headache effect of the analgesia. So headache formulas will usually have caffeine in them. Now, it's kind of a double-edged sword because when the caffeine wears off, you sometimes get a rebound dilation, which makes the headache worse. So, you know, use it at your own risk. Now, let's go back to these indications right here. For aspirin, we had all these things. For the other NSAIDs, we have suppression of inflammation, analgesia, reduction of fever, and dysmenorrhea, not these other things. Okay, so for ibuprofen, we've got all of these things. For a drug like Celebrex, really you just have analgesia and suppression of inflammation. So really the drugs are all very similar except aspirin, which has those extra things. And the reason it has the extra things is because it binds irreversibly. All right, talking about aspirin. It comes in a lot of different forms. Tablets are the regular one. Buffered tablets. What's a buffered tablet? Is aspirin normally basic or acidic? It's normally acidic. So if you give it in combination with a drug like bicarbonate, which is basic, it will buffer the acidic nature. Supposedly doesn't upset the stomach as much. You can have buffered solutions where, you know, you give the aspirin, mix in some bicarbonate in with it. Same thing. Enteric coated. It is an aspirin that does not dissolve until it gets through the stomach. The idea is you can have fewer stomach side effects. Now, it might stop GI pain. It does not reduce the risk of ulcers. Time-released, where it releases it constantly throughout the day. You can also take it as rectal suppositories. Now, the typical dose of aspirin is 325 milligrams, one tablet, or two tablets, which would be 650. Now, a low dose, formerly known as baby aspirin, the tablet formerly known as baby aspirin, is 81 milligrams. Now, if you take four of these, what dose would that be? 324, which is basically one regular aspirin. Now, this low-dose aspirin is used for prevention of heart attack and stroke. It is not used to treat heart attack, just to prevent. To treat heart attack, you want to take at least 160 and up to 325. Right, that's your preventative maintenance. But say again? 160. Yeah, 160 would be two low-dose aspirins. So if a person has a heart attack, the recommended dose is somewhere between 160 and 325. So between two and four of the low-dose aspirins. All right. Very important thing for people to know is that ibuprofen does not prevent heart attacks. Naproxen does not prevent heart attacks. Celebrex does not prevent heart attacks. The only NSAID that prevents heart attacks is aspirin. So, you know, sometimes, I mean, people can do some silly things. They'll go, yeah, I've got a heart attack. Well, let me take some ibuprofen. I mean, that's the same thing as aspirin, right? Or they take the whole bottle. You know, that doesn't work either. How much aspirin should a person take for a heart if they're having a heart attack? Okay. So 160 to 325. So if they've got a bottle of regular aspirin in their hand, how many do you tell them to take? One. All right. You need to be able to recognize the drugs. Really, the only ones I'm going to ask you about is going to be ibuprofen, naproxen, Toradol, and Indocin. The rest will not appear on a test near you.
If it's a large person having a heart attack, should you give them a higher dose?
No, you don't give them a higher dose. No.
How would you distinguish whether between 160 and 325?
Your hospital protocol.